AWS re:Invent 2025, held December 1st through the 5th, 2025, in Las Vegas, Nevada. And welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Lauren Sanchez.
And I'm Max Scott. And I have to say, I'm still recovering from just the sheer volume of it all. It felt less like a conference and more like a tectonic shift.
A tectonic shift is the perfect analogy. It really is. We are facing down, over 1,000 different sessions, keynotes, product announcements.
An avalanche of information.
It's an avalanche. And so our mission today for you is to do a really rigorous MECE synthesis.
Mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive.
Exactly. We want to make sure you get the absolute core takeaways, the insights that truly, truly matter without getting buried under all that noise.
And that synthesis is, I think, essential because the volume, it kind of obscured a very, very clear signal.
Okay.
This year wasn't about small incremental changes to cloud infrastructure.
Yeah.
It really marked the definitive and I'd say irreversible shift in the software development world.
Oh, that's a big claim.
It is. We're moving beyond generative AI as just a simple, a sophisticated tool like a writing assistant or a code completer.
Right.
And we are now establishing agentic AI as the new foundational software development paradigm.
Okay, let's unpack that. A new paradigm implies a fundamental change in how we architect everything. So what does that look like in practice? Why is this shift so profound?
It's really the shift from simple generation to complex autonomous execution. For the past couple of years, the whole focus was on how an LLM could complete a single task, right?
Write an email, summarize a document, that kind of thing.
Exactly. The new focus is entirely on autonomous multi-agent systems that can execute these incredibly complex, long-running business processes end-to-end without constant human supervision.
So they're goal-oriented. They plan, they execute.
And they course-correct. It's a whole different level of autonomy.
That sounds incredibly ambitious. Do we have the data to back up that kind of acceleration?
We do. And the analyst projections that were shared were, frankly, stunning. They're predicting that by 2028, a full 33% of enterprise software applications will include significant agentic AI capabilities.
33%.
And to really appreciate the speed of that, you have to remember that's up from only about 1% last year.
Wow. So in just 3 years, a third of all new systems will be agent-driven.
That's the projection.
Mm.
And that kind of rapid acceleration, it mandates an entirely new set of foundational services and infrastructure. This is why we saw the announcements we did. The cloud, it needs to be built not just for humans anymore, but for autonomous agents.
And if the cloud is now being built for autonomous agents, we need the platform to actually run them.
You do.
So let's start there with the production engine for this new world.
Precisely. This shift demands a standardized, a scalable, and a secure environment. And that brings us straight to Agent Core.
Right. Amazon Bedrock's Agent Core. This is the managed, serverless, purpose-built service, and it was introduced specifically to eliminate that that undifferentiated heavy lifting involved in managing and securing these really sophisticated multi-step agents.
Exactly. And that seems to be the crucial distinction, right? We're moving out of the, let's call the hobbyist phase of AI and into the real enterprise production phase.
Where things like identity management and persistence, they're not just nice to haves, they're absolutely non-negotiable.
Absolutely. AWS recognized that engineers were spending just enormous amounts of time patching together solutions for transparency, for access control, concurrency, error handling.
All the hard stuff.
All the hard stuff. So Agent Core packages this all up into a modular, highly available architecture. And I think we should start with the fundamental piece that surprised a lot of developers, the Agent Core runtime.
The runtime. So that handles the serverless execution environment. Now, we've had serverless execution for years with Lambda. Why do we need a new runtime specifically for agents? Isn't Lambda designed for those short, bursty tasks?
That is the critical difference. You hit it right there. Traditional serverless platforms like Lambda, they're optimized for quick execution, rapid scale-up, but they often have hard duration limits.
15 minutes max, something like that?
Right, because they're designed to be stateless. Autonomous agents, though, they're often handling these long-running, really complex batch processes. Think about a multi-day supply chain optimization or a deep compliance audit.
You can't run that in 15 minutes.
You can't.
Yeah.
If you try to run those complex multi-step workflows on a platform that's built for short bursts, you just run into state management nightmares. You get execution timeouts.
So how does Agent Core solve this?
It uses these optimized micro VMs, so similar to the foundation of EC2, but they're tuned for millisecond launch times and just minimal resource overhead. And crucially, this runtime supports agents running for prolonged periods of time.
So you get persistence.
You get persistence, but with the elasticity of serverless. It's really the combination that's needed for this kind of multi-turn, long goal execution.
Okay, that persistence requirement, that flows directly into the security layer, especially identity. An autonomous agent that's operating on behalf of a user or a system, it's going to need access to corporate APIs, databases, all sorts of sensitive resources.
Of course.
How do you manage secure access control without just giving the agent these massively broad permissions?
And that's where the Agent Core Identity Service really shines. It enforces that principle of least privilege, and it does it automatically. It all hinges on the token exchange mechanism.
The token exchange.
So when an authorized user starts a task with an agent, maybe through a web portal, Agent Core takes that user's incoming access token, which usually has broad user-level permissions.
Right.
It then combines that with the agent's own specific identity and its permission set.
Hold on. Why not just use the user's token? Why the extra step?
Because that is the core security vulnerability it addresses. If the agent just used the user's full token, any error, any misuse, even a malicious prompt targeting the agent could exploit the user's broad permissions globally.
Ah.
Instead, Agent Core generates a very granular workload access token. And this final token, it's narrowly scoped. It grants permission only for the specific action the agent needs to invoke right at that moment, like retrieving a single customer record and only to the resource it's authorized to touch.
It's a necessary friction point for security.
It is. It's essential for an automated multi-step environment.
Okay, so identity is solved. Now let's talk about memory, because this is what really elevates an LLM from just a smart chatbot into a true agent that's capable of learning and adapting.
Absolutely. And Agent Core provides these managed memory primitives. Now, we already had managed short-term context memory, you know, for the current conversation.
Right.
And long-term summary memory for general facts. But the big announcement was episodic memory.
Episodic memory. Now, you mentioned in our prep that this is about learning the user's style and their preferences, but that sounds like a massive data governance headache.
It does.
How did AWS make sure that collecting this really personal user interaction data is, you know, compliant, that it isn't just creating a massive new vector for PII leakage?
The skepticism is well-founded. I mean, it's the exact question every enterprise is asking. The key distinction here is how Bedrock manages that data.
Okay.
Episodic memory isn't just dumping raw chat logs into a bucket. It specifically captures meta details, like the communication tone you prefer, the specific subjects you frequently ask about.
The complexity level of the answers you seem to respond to best.
Exactly. The data is highly structured. And crucially, because it's part of the Bedrock managed service, it's stored in compliance-ready storage. It's isolated per customer, and it's subject to very clear data retention and deletion policies.
So it's more about steering the agent's behavior, not just storing new PII.
Precisely. It moves beyond just remembering the last few turns of the conversation to actually understanding user context and communication style for a much more effective interaction.
So if I consistently use, say, highly formal business language, the agent learns to mirror that formality in its responses, regardless of what I'm asking about.
Precisely. It learns your communication pattern, which makes the whole interaction feel much more native to your style. Now, to make these smart agents useful, they have to collaborate and use tools. And this is all governed by the Agent Core Gateway.
Also called the Model Context Protocol, or MCP.
Right. And the MCP is really, it's the linchpin. It's the critical piece that enables composability by acting as this centralized tool registry and gateway.
Explain that. What were the older methods and why were they so inefficient?
Well, think about the old way of building agents. If you had, say, 20 tools APIs, databases, Lambda functions, the agent had to consider all 20 descriptions every single time it made a decision.
You had to overload the LLM's context window with all of that?
You had to. And that makes the LLM call slower, it makes it more expensive, and you quickly, you know, you bump up against the token limits for any kind of complex workflow.
So the inefficiency just compounds with every single tool you add.
Exactly. The Agent Core Gateway completely revolutionizes this. It lets agents discover and invoke tools using semantic search against the registry.
So instead of sending all 20 descriptions to the LLM,
the agent just sends a query like, I need to look up customer credit history.
Yeah.
The MCP does a quick semantic search on the tool registry. It identifies the one relevant credit check API, and only then does it provide the necessary technical details, like the API signature, to the LLM.
So it decouples the planning from the execution.
That's it. It decouples them, drastically improving efficiency and flexibility.
That makes so much sense. Agents are now these distributed systems that need a standardized, governed way to communicate. Okay, let's pivot to the people building these systems. If agents are generating this flood of code, traditional engineering teams must be facing a real productivity crisis.
Well, they absolutely are. The analysis that was shared showed that LLMs are generating so much code that engineers are now seeing about 70% more code per engineer than they did in 2023.
70%? That's a massive influx of change.
It's huge. All this new code, new configuration, it requires faster, safer review mechanisms and better tools that can actually keep pace with AI speed.
Yeah.
You can't just throw 7 times the boilerplate code at a human reviewer and expect them to keep up.
So we need an agent for the engineer. And I guess that's where the Kiro Agentic IDE comes in, the specialized development environment that's tailored for these agentic workflows.
Kiro is focused fundamentally on what they're calling spec-driven development. Most of your general-purpose code assistants, they generate generic, well-formed code. But that code often fails the instant it hits an enterprise environment.
Because it violates some internal policy.
Right. It might use the wrong logging framework or fail to adhere to a specific security standard or use an unauthorized design pattern.
That grounding issue is a huge problem. So how does Kiro solve it? How does it make that generic AI code specific to the enterprise?
Kiro addresses this by leveraging custom steering documents. These are local guidance documents that you, as the organization, you point Kiro at them. They contain all your domain-specific knowledge.
Like your preferred coding standards, your internal testing frameworks,
your logging requirements, your legal compliance rules, all of it. This information actively grounds the LLM's responses. So instead of generating generic Python, it generates Python that already meets your company's internal standards and uses your bespoke data validation library from day one.
That really pushes the AI from just a coding assistant to a policy enforcer. It's ensuring the output is secure and compliant by design.
And Kiro enhances that governance with something called agent hooks.
Okay.
These are automations that are triggered by specific IDE events. So for example, if you finish a new microservice component and you hit save, an agent hook can automatically trigger a run to update the RayADME file, generate the API documentation.
Or run an initial security scan.
Exactly. It automates all that mundane but critical work, ensuring consistency and governance without the developer having to remember every single step in the checklist.
And for those who need to build agents quickly, maybe without the full IDE, we also saw the introduction of an open source toolkit.
That's the Strands Agents SDK. It's available in Python and TypeScript. And its main goal is just simplicity. Specifically, it abstracts away the most frustrating part of agent building, managing the complex conversation history and session context. When you build an agent, you're dealing with this recursive event loop.
User message comes in, planning happens, a tool gets called.
The tool returns, a response is generated. And if a tool fails or if memory retrieval times out, trying to manage the reassembly of that context is, frankly, a nightmare.
The dreaded state management loop.
Strands handles that automatically through its built-in event loop architecture. It keeps the conversation management clean and robust, which lets developers focus purely on the business logic and the tools their agents need to use.
So it simplifies rapid prototyping.
Immensely. It makes deploying onto existing serverless environments like Lambda with API Gateway just trivial.
Okay, so we have the platform with Agent Core, we have the development tools with Kiro and Strands. But deploying these autonomous systems comes with really complex operational challenges that we have to talk about. Latency, cost, and ultimately, trust.
Absolutely, the agentic challenges. And let's start with the big operational bottleneck, compounding latency.
Compounding latency.
As these workflows become more goal-oriented, they require a sequence of steps. Each step might involve memory retrieval, an LLM call for planning, a tool invocation, and then another LLM call to process the tool output.
And all of those steps are executed serially, one after another.
Exactly. So if each step takes, say, 500 milliseconds, a 4-step agentic workflow already consumes 2 full seconds before the final response is even assembled.
And you multiply that across thousands of users, and those multi-turn conversations become incredibly expensive and just frustratingly slow.
Right. This operational friction is what will sink enterprise AI adoption if it's not managed aggressively.
And if you can't observe every step of that complex, multi-turn decision tree, you can't possibly trust the agent's output. And this is where AI observability, it seems to go from a nice-to-have to absolutely mission-critical.
It is essential for trust and transparency, especially when there's money or regulation involved. Agent Core observability gives you a 360-degree view of these agent workflows. It tracks detailed session traces, logs every single LLM call, records the success rate of tool invocations.
And it monitors those critical latency percentiles.
Yes, by 50, 295, and P99.
And can you just remind our listener why those percentiles matter so much more than a simple average latency figure?
A simple average can lie to you.
Right.
It really can. Yeah. If 90% of your users get a 500 millisecond response, but 10% get a 10-second response because of some resource spike,
your average still looks great, but 1 in 10 of your customers is having a terrible experience.
Exactly. P95 latency. So the speed experienced by 95% of your users, that's the gold standard for measuring real customer experience. Observability helps us debug those failures, optimize the context assembly, and answer the ultimate question for regulators. Is the agent making reliable, repeatable, and correct decisions?
And then finally, the unavoidable issue of security. Autonomous agents, they introduce entirely new attack surfaces. Prompt injection, data leakage through a tool.
This brings us to a crucial element of AI security. And the first line of defense is Bedrock guardrails.
Okay.
You deploy guardrails to set restricted topics, and you apply these proactive checks on both the input, so what the user asks, and the output, what the agent generates. And this moves beyond just generic moderation.
How so?
Well, if a policy is triggered, let's say the user tries to ask the agent to override a financial transaction limit, you can prevent the agent from even responding. Or you can have it return a custom moderator response that explains the policy violation.
It's about extending traditional security postures.
It really is. We have Cloud Security Posture Management, CSPM, for infrastructure.
Yeah.
We now need AI Security Posture Management, or AI SPM, for these agentic workloads. And guardrails also allows for custom moderation models that are tailored to your specific enterprise risks, ensuring the agent stays within defined legal and ethical boundaries.
So it sounds like the overall message from this whole first part is loud and clear. Agentic AI is ready for production.
Yes.
But only because the foundational platform, the identity, security, memory, and observability has finally been engineered for enterprise-grade governance, something that GenAI as a tool never really required.
That is the complete picture. It's a full-stack commitment to autonomy.
And that commitment to autonomy requires just staggering amounts of processing power, which leads us perfectly into the hardware. All this agentic activity, all this new code generation, it requires serious horsepower running underneath the cloud.
So let's talk about the next generation of custom silicon. We are now talking about Graviton 5. Graviton 5. This represents the sixth generation of custom silicon developed by AWS. And the Graviton journey is fascinating because it started primarily focusing on scale-out workloads.
Right, web servers, containers, microservices.
Exactly. But Graviton 4 already marked a pivot. It delivered massive performance increases that were critical for scale-up workloads.
Can you define those scale-up workloads? Why are they historically so hard to migrate off legacy hardware?
Scale-up workloads are those that demand just enormous amounts of memory, high I/O throughput, and really deep CPU single-thread performance. They often require specialized, expensive licensing.
So we're talking about massive relational databases, like a 10-terabyte Aurora cluster.
Or in-memory caches like Redis, or even really specialized workloads like electronic design automation, EDA, which simulates complex chip designs. Graviton 4 gave a huge boost there, but Graviton 5 continues this trend with even greater price performance.
And the value proposition is still that you get these benefits with minimal effort.
That's the key. You get substantial performance benefits, often in the double-digit percentage gains over comparable by 86 instances, with very little work. For customers already using managed services like RDS or EMR, these benefits are realized almost like a free performance upgrade when AWS migrates the underlying fleet.
It's performance without the pain of re-architecture. And this ties into a broader theme that we saw being pushed hard, the sustainability angle.
It's inextricably linked. Custom, highly optimized silicon like Graviton 5 is a major sustainability driver.
Because it increases compute efficiency per watt.
Right. Less power used per transaction means less heat generated, which means lower cooling requirements. And this pairs with AWS's broader efforts in efficient data center design, using advanced evaporative cooling and even using lower carbon concrete in construction. The efficiency is baked in from the ground up, all the way to the instruction set.
Okay, so shifting from the physical chips to how we orchestrate them, all this optimized compute has to be managed at enormous scale, especially with the rapid adoption of containers. Which brings us to new capabilities in EKS.
The headline here is EKS Auto Mode. This is a massive simplification tool. It fully automates Kubernetes cluster management across compute, storage, and networking.
Which is huge because for a lot of enterprise users, Kubernetes is powerful, but it's incredibly complex to manage in production.
The operational lifting is heavy. Patching, node replacement, right-sizing.
I have to inject a little skepticism here. Kubernetes is notoriously complex, and a lot of our listeners are running mission-critical production systems on it. Is EKS Auto Mode really ready for those complex critical environments, or is this more for dev and test?
That's a fair and necessary challenge. The initial rollout is clearly aimed at accelerating adoption by removing those undifferentiated tasks. EKS Auto Mode really acts as a personal Kubernetes assistant. It provisions optimal compute based on your workload's needs. It scales node groups automatically.
And it does multi-AZ by default for high availability.
By default. It specifically targets the operational overhead of lifecycle management patching CVEs, replacing failed nodes, scaling capacity, all of which are now automated and tested by AWS. So while the most niche, hyper-optimized clusters might still need manual configuration, Auto Mode drastically lowers the barrier to entry for standard enterprise production workloads.
It's a step toward democratizing high-scale orchestration.
It is. And speaking of high-scale, EKS is also tackling extreme performance demands, moving way beyond what we traditionally thought Kubernetes could handle.
Especially around transactional systems.
Right. And this was demonstrated by their innovation around running DynamoDB on EKS. Traditionally, the core bottleneck in standard Kubernetes is et cetera.
The consistent key value store that holds the entire state of the cluster.
Right. And every write operation has to be synchronized across the et cetera quorum, which really limits the achievable transactional throughput. You often cap out around a few thousand transactions per second.
So if you hit that et cetera bottleneck, your whole cluster state management just grinds to a halt.
Exactly. So to break that bottleneck for a workload like DynamoDB, which needs extreme low latency and massive TPS, they needed a radical decoupling. They achieved peak throughputs of 8 to 9,000 write requests per second.
How?
By using EMR HBase for low latency and implementing a next generation data store general backend. This architecture essentially bypasses et cetera for the actual high volume transaction logging. It pushes that heavy lifting to a specialized high-performance data plane.
So et cetera only has to maintain the core cluster metadata.
That's it. This shows EKS evolving to handle the most demanding, transactional, stateful workloads imaginable.
That focus on breaking bottlenecks leads us naturally from performance to resilience, bringing us to what they call the latency mandate. This is where geography and architecture really intersect, especially for legacy modernization.
And the inability to tolerate latency is probably the single biggest reason why companies keep workloads stuck in expensive old on-prem data centers.
Right, because standard connectivity from on-prem to a main AWS region might have, what, 40 to 60 milliseconds of latency?
At least. And that's just unacceptable for many legacy applications, like certain manufacturing control systems or highly interactive financial apps.
And that is the exact gap that local zones are meant to fill.
Precisely. We saw an acceleration in deployment. There are 43 local zones globally now. And the crucial detail here is that local zones connect to their parent availability zone with sub-2 millisecond latency.
Sub-2 milliseconds? That's a game changer.
It is. They essentially act as an extension of the AWS region right next to the customer's facility, connected by high-speed fiber. And that difference between 40 meters and less than 2 meters enables the migration of those latency-sensitive workloads that were previously locked in the customer's building.
It accelerates true cloud exit strategies.
It really does. And for those companies that are embracing a multi-cloud resilient strategy, they also address the issue of interconnectivity.
The new capability for 10 gig or 100 gig connections between AWS and Google Cloud.
Which is incredibly significant. Building highly resilient, private, cross-cloud connectivity, that traditionally required setting up a relationship with a third-party co-location provider, which adds cost, complexity, and a single point of failure.
And this new direct capability simplifies all that.
It does. It achieves 99.99% of availability, 99.99% for cross-cloud connectivity, without that co-location burden. It fundamentally streamlines multi-cloud resilience.
And the general architectural philosophy is evolving too, moving from just multi-AZ or multi-region to something more robust, anti-fragile systems.
It's a philosophical shift. Anti-fragility, a term from Nassim Taleb, means systems don't just survive disruptions, they actually get stronger under stress.
And in practice, what does that mean?
In practice, it means aggressively moving toward multi-region architectures to eliminate those on-prem data dependencies. But critically, it's enforced through rigorous testing.
The rise of advanced chaos engineering.
Exactly. Organizations are simulating novel, rare events, failures they've never seen before, to validate that incident fixes actually work and improve the system's ability to withstand future unknown disruptions. It's an active, not a passive, approach to resilience.
Okay, let's wrap up compute with the Security Foundation. Confidential computing. This is the bedrock of trust for AI workloads, especially with proprietary models and sensitive data.
And the foundation there is the Nitro system.
Yeah.
What a lot of people forget is that Nitro provides always-on confidential computing for any modern EC2 instance released since 2018.
And it's free with no performance penalty.
Right. It isolates the guest OS and hypervisor from the host hardware management.
But the core question for the customer is always, how can I verify that the code running inside that highly isolated environment is exactly what I deployed, that it hasn't been tampered with?
And that is the utility of attestable images. Think of your server image, the OS, and the application code as having a tamper-proof digital fingerprint. It's a cryptographic hash of its full contents.
So when the image is created, the system generates this hash.
And then at runtime, when the instance boots up inside the secure micro VM from Nitro, the trustworthy Nitro stack regenerates those same hashes. It then provides an attestation document, which is verifiable cryptographic proof that exactly matches the fingerprint of the image you deployed.
So you can prove exactly what code is running in that isolated environment.
Which for AI is paramount. It ensures your IP protection during training, and it meets regulatory compliance for highly confidential financial or health data.
That level of verifiable trust, coupled with the speed of Graviton 5 and the simplicity of EKS Auto Mode, it shows a massive, synchronized focus on building an auditable, high-performance foundation for this next wave of software.
Okay, let's move on to the third major pillar. All this agentic power and optimized compute is, frankly, useless without high-quality, governable, accessible data. So where did the focus land on the data layer? Reinvent really solidified the continued evolution of the data layer, and it particularly confirmed the dominance of the modern lakehouse architecture. And for the industry, you can't have a conversation about the lakehouse now without talking about the open table format, Apache Iceberg.
We've seen Iceberg gain enormous traction everywhere. So what is AWS doing to simplify its adoption?
They're productizing it aggressively. AWS is simplifying the whole process by offering S3 tables as a fully managed Apache Iceberg layer. This removes the operational complexity that a lot of companies struggle with.
Things like managing the metadata catalog, schema evolution, file versioning, all the hard parts of Iceberg.
All of it. And this is a major step because Iceberg provides those core capabilities that traditional data lakes just lacked.
Mm-hmm.
Reliability, schema evolution, so you can change your table structure without breaking old queries.
And time travel capability, so you can query the state of your data from last Tuesday.
Exactly. And by managing it as S3 tables, AWS is making these advanced features standard and resilient.
And they built in critical resilience features right from the start, didn't they?
They did. S3 tables support simple managed replication capabilities. Same region, cross region, same account, cross account. The critical actionable advice for you, the listener, is this. To optimize your data lake for both agility and cost, you have to transition to using S3 tables. You have to actively right-size your files, avoiding that notorious small files problem.
Which just kills query performance.
Kills it. And you have to implement smart partitioning. This balances the reliability of the Iceberg format with the cost efficiency of object storage.
Now, a huge challenge for massive, established enterprises is data sprawl. I mean, decades of institutional knowledge are often locked away in proprietary file systems that the modern AI and analytics engines can't easily touch.
It's a classic modernization challenge. It's often tied up in expensive, proprietary NAS storage like NetApp on ANTAP.
Yeah.
That institutional knowledge, decades of documents, contracts, images, it's trapped.
And it requires these expensive, complicated, and risky ETL jobs to move into the data lake, which means it just stays stuck and inaccessible to your new agentic AI tools.
Exactly. The solution that was announced was the capability to use S3 access points for FSx. And this is brilliant because it allows you to seamlessly connect that file data directly to AWS Analytics, AI, and compute services like SageMaker, Athena, or Bedrock without ever having to physically move the data.
So the data remains accessible via traditional file protocols like SMB or NFS for the legacy apps.
While simultaneously being available as S3 objects for modern cloud tools, it immediately unlocks this huge treasure trove of data for AI consumption.
Speaking of modernization, let's look at the actual code. How are agents transforming the monumental task of updating legacy code bases? I mean, this is a decade-long project for many enterprises.
This is the return of AWS Transform, and it's now turbocharged with expert agents specifically for modernization. We're talking about tackling legacy mainframes, .NET systems, full Windows stacks, and SQL Server databases, often targeting conversion to open source databases like Aurora PostgreSQL.
I was very interested in the methodology here. It's not just translating COBOL syntax to Java syntax, which, you know, historically has just created this horrible, unmaintainable code. How does the agent approach this?
It's a complete shift from translation to re-architecting. The expert agent first performed this deep semantic analysis on the legacy code, say thousands of lines of COBOL. Its primary task is to extract the core business rules embedded in that code.
So it's identifying the logic, the decision points, the F then LC blocks that define, for instance, the precise logic for loan adjudication?
Exactly. And then, based on that extracted logic, the agent reimagines how that business logic should be re-implemented in the modern target code base like Java or Python using best practices and modern cloud patterns. It dramatically accelerates modernization timelines.
And it must have the side benefit of helping identify and eliminate dead code.
It does. Logic tied to regulatory requirements that don't even exist anymore. It frees up major maintenance stalls.
That focus on extracting business value, not just syntax, brings us back to the value imperative in AI adoption. We can't just modernize for the sake of it.
It's absolutely crucial. Successful AI adoption has to start with AI for value, not AI for AI's sake. We've seen so many enterprises stumble when they try to tackle the hardest core business competency problems, the crown jewels, right out of the gate.
So what's the prescription? What does a low-risk, high-return AI initiative look like?
The recommendation is to focus first on low-risk problems that offer immediate, quantifiable financial wins. A great example is reducing the time spent on regulatory documentation processing or simplifying internal operational tasks like invoice reconciliation.
Things where the value can be quantified by eliminating hundreds of hours of manual checks per month?
Precisely. That immediate financial win funds the more complex transformation projects later. You build trust and an internal AI capability on simpler tasks before you tackle the core business engine.
That's smart, tangible advice. Now, let's pivot from innovation to the very practical concerns of cloud financial management, financial transparency, and cost governance. This is paramount for large organizations.
And two critical features were introduced to address this organizational complexity. The first is building transfer. This is essential for channel partners, managed service providers, and resellers.
Why is that so important?
Because it allows them to consolidate billing for dozens of end customers into a single AWS organization, which allows them to protect the true invoicing cost, the raw AWS pricing, from their end customers. The reseller handles the markup and consolidation, and it solves a massive logistical and contractual headache for the entire partner ecosystem.
And then there's the flexibility needed to manage those costs internally across different business units.
And that's covered by pricing rules. This feature lets administrators apply global or service-specific discounts and markups to AWS services. For a large enterprise, this is highly useful for internal chargeback models.
Where central IT needs to charge different business units different rates to cover shared tooling or staffing.
Right. And for partners, it lets them bake their margin rules directly into the platform instead of tracking it all in a spreadsheet somewhere.
And we even saw some highly specific real-world examples of how improved visibility tools translate directly to significant savings.
Those examples really bring the governance discussion to life. One customer saved a confirmed $13,000 per month simply by using visibility tools to identify infrequently accessed objects in S3 standard and migrating them to intelligent tiering.
$13,000 a month.
And another example involved identifying and deleting an unused 1 petabyte bucket. A massive amount of storage just sitting there, identified entirely through these visibility tools. These are significant savings.
Okay, finally, let's wrap this section up with database modernization and innovation. There's always been complexity when we talk about data consistency and performance, particularly in distributed systems.
And this centers on the age-old database problem.
Yeah.
How do you explain the relationship between isolation, correctness, and performance to application programmers?
Yeah.
AWS highlighted innovations within Aurora DSpool Distributed SQL.
Right. Historically, achieving higher transaction consistency, like read committed, was just inherently expensive because it required synchronous write locks and coordination.
So the higher the guarantee, the slower the performance. That was the trade-off.
Yeah.
The innovation in Aurora DSQL shows that this is no longer a fixed trade-off. Certain transactions are no longer inherently more expensive. The cost is now entirely dependent on your workload patterns.
So the system is smarter about minimizing coordination overhead dynamically.
It is. But it means that application engineers now have to deeply understand their specific data access needs to leverage these advances. It moves the complexity, in a way, from the database engine to the programmer's understanding of their own transactions.
And for large-scale data migration, especially from legacy systems like Oracle, we saw a unique phased approach illustrated by a customer example.
The Equifax migration was a masterclass in modernization tactics. They had to migrate 30 to 40 terabytes of binary data blobs and CLOBs from Oracle. And these data types are notoriously difficult to manage transactionally.
So what was their solution?
Their winning tactic was to migrate this large binary data first, but not to their target database. They moved it to S3. They used Kafka Change Data Capture to manage incremental changes, converted historical data to Parquet.
And only after this massive binary data was externalized and secured did they proceed with migrating the rest of the structured data to Aurora Postgres.
Exactly. It's a complex, phased approach that minimizes risk, accelerates the process, and ensures the new data foundation is clean and optimized.
That truly highlights how modernization is less about a single flip of a switch and more about a strategic, multi-stage, data-specific approach. Okay, that was a comprehensive journey through the most impactful announcements of re:Invent 2025. What is the three-part thesis we should leave our listener with?
I think we saw three major interconnected shifts. First, the definitive move to the agentic development paradigm. The platform is no longer just for microservices. It's for autonomous, multi-agent systems, supported by Agent Core for governance and scaling.
And acceleration tools like Kiro for secure, spec-driven development.
Right. Second, the high-performance engine powering this shift. Optimized compute. We saw the continuation of custom silicon leadership with Graviton 5, providing huge price-performance advantages.
And the democratization of complex orchestration through EKS Auto Mode, all built on a foundation of always-on, verifiable security via the Nitro Systems attestable images.
And third, the insistence on a solid data foundation and financial governance. This means embracing open formats for reliability, like Iceberg via S3 tables, unlocking decades of institutional knowledge, and demanding AI for value that quantifies its return.
And if we wrap all of that up, the biggest meta change is really the transition of heavy lifting. The complexity, the state management, the boilerplate, from the human engineer to the autonomous trustworthy agent.
That's it. The platform is now designed for agents to execute complex, multi-turn goals across every single layer of the stack.
Perfect summary.
But before we close, the sources hinted at a critical next step that organizations have to begin preparing for now. If agentic AI is the focus for 2026, the next frontier is the inevitable intersection of quantum and AI.
The intersection of quantum computing and AI, that sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but the reality is starting to show some demonstrable advantage, isn't it?
It is. Quantum computers are exponential accelerators for certain types of complex problems. Traditionally, that was confined to really specialized fields like material science, chemistry, drug discovery.
Right.
But the surprise, the thing that changes the planning horizon, is that quantum acceleration is starting to show concrete advantages for certain classical optimization problems, too.
How does that work?
These are hybrid algorithms. A quantum computer processes a specific, incredibly complex kernel of data, a calculation that would take a classical supercomputer weeks, and then it feeds that result back into the classical machine to complete the larger workflow.
And the challenge this poses for organizations is one of enablement.
It is. If you're just focusing on AI enablement, you're now behind. Organizations have to dedicate time to quantum enablement alongside AI enablement in the next 18 months, preparing their data pipelines, training their workforce on hybrid algorithms, and identifying specific use cases where that combination of autonomous agents and quantum acceleration will deliver exponential returns.
That is a highly provocative thought to leave us with. The future of autonomous execution isn't just AI, it's AI plus quantum. An incredible look at what's coming.
It was a massive year for the cloud. My pleasure.
To you, our listener, we hope you take these deep insights and apply them directly to your own learning and transformation journey. We'll catch you next time.